Welcome. Thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are on a listen-only mode. After today's presentation, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star one on your touch-tone phone. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the conference over to Ms. Leticia Davila. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you, Julianne. Good afternoon. I am Leticia Davila, and I am representing the Clinician Outreach and Communication Activity, COCA, with the Emergency Communication System at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I am delighted to welcome you to today's COCA conference call, Multi-State Outbreak Fungal Meningitis and Other Infections, Updated Clinical Guidance. We are pleased to have with us today Dr. Schaefer and Dr. Jernigan from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They will provide updated information on the multi-state investigation of fungal meningitis and other infections, including epidural abscess, as well as other clinical syndromes being diagnosed in exposed patients. They will also review CDC's diagnostic and treatment recommendations for clinicians. There is no continuing education or slides provided for this call. Event-specific resources for clinicians are available on our COCA website at emergency.cdc.gov/COCA. Our first presenter today is Dr. Melissa Schaefer. Dr. Schaefer is a medical officer in the Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion at the CDC. She currently works on the Ambulatory and Long-Term Care Team in the division. Her efforts focus on infection prevention in ambulatory care settings, with a particular emphasis on ambulatory surgical centers and issues related to injection safety. We also have Dr. John Jernigan speaking with us today. Dr. Jernigan is the clinical team lead of the multi-state meningitis outbreak and director of the Office of Health-Associated Infections Prevention Research and Evaluation in the Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion at CDC. He is also a clinical associate professor of medicine at the Emory University School of Medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases. In addition to today's presenters, Dr. Anu Malani will be available to answer questions during the Q&A section of today's COCA call. Dr. Malani is the Associate Medical Director for Infection Prevention and Control and the Medical Director for Antimicrobial Stewardship at St. Joseph's Mercy Medical Center in Ann Arbor, Michigan. At the end of the presentation, you will have the opportunity to ask the presenters questions. On the phone, dialing star 1 will put you in the queue for questions. At this time, please welcome our first presenter, Dr. Schaefer.
Thanks, Leticia. So as Leticia mentioned, I'm going to start out by giving a brief update, and then I'll turn it over to Dr. Jernigan to go through the health advisory alert that was released by CDC last week, and then we'll open it up for question and answers. So this is our fourth COCA call on this multi-state outbreak of fungal meningitis and other infections associated with 3 lots of methylprednisolone acetate from the New England Compounding Center. Per usual, the details of the investigation, including all the materials we've discussed here, case counts, case definitions, diagnostic and treatment guidance are all posted on the CDC website. We update that frequently, so please check back frequently and look at the date for the document you're using to make sure that you're using the most up-to-date information. The focus of this call is to give some updated numbers for the investigation and to describe some of the syndromes that we're currently seeing in patients presenting from this outbreak. As I mentioned, this was described in the HON re-release last week. So the case counts are posted on the CDC website every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday currently. And so the case counts that we have as of yesterday, November 26, are that CDC has received reports of 510 cases, including 36 deaths in 19 states associated with this outbreak. Dr. Jernigan, I'm going to turn it over to him now to give an update on the HON and to describe the kind of transition that we're seeing in the types of cases being reported to CDC currently.
Thanks, Melissa. As Dr. Schaefer mentioned, we're continuing to see new cases reported more than now 8 weeks after the three implicated lots of methylprednisolone acetate were recalled. However, the majority of the new cases that were reported to us in the past have been meningitis, and we're seeing a transition in the types of the clinical presentation of the cases that are being reported to us more recently. We've recently observed an increase in the number of patients presenting with evidence of epidural abscess, phlegmon, discitis, vertebral osteomyelitis, or arachnoiditis at or near the site of the injection. And we've seen these complications occurring in patients both with and without evidence of fungal meningitis. Of the cases that have been reported to CDC in the last few weeks, the majority actually have not been cases of primarily meningitis, but rather these spinal and paraspinal infections. Right, it's important to note that the overall trend in the number of cases being reported is still going down. It's just that a larger proportion of those that are being recently reported are some of these paraspinal or spinal infections. Our current diagnostic and treatment guidance addresses management of these patients that have epidural abscess and other complications at or near the injection site. These infections may occur in isolation or in patients previously diagnosed with fungal meningitis, as I said. It's important to note that although these patients with these localized infections frequently have new or worsening back pain, the symptoms may in fact be quite mild or very clinically difficult to distinguish from the patient's baseline chronic pain that called for the injections in the first place. We have made some slight alterations to our guidance last week. It's currently active on our website based upon this new information. And I'll relay that to you now. Our recommendations are that in patients with new or worsening symptoms at or near the injection site, physicians should obtain an MRI with contrast of the symptomatic areas if the MRI is not contraindicated. This recommendation also applies to patients being treated for meningitis. In some cases, the radiologic evidence of abscess or phlegmon has become apparent on repeat MRI studies performed subsequent to an initially normal imaging procedure. Clinicians should therefore have a very low threshold for repeat MRI studies in patients who continue to have symptoms localizing to the site of injection even after a normal study. However, we're not sure what the optimal duration between MRI studies should be. We have received reports of patients being treated for fungal meningitis who had no previous evidence of localized infection at the site of injection, but who were subsequently found to have evidence of localized infection, such as epidural abscess, on imaging studies. Therefore, in patients who are being treated for meningitis, even in the absence of new or worsening symptoms at or near the injection site, clinicians should strongly consider obtaining an MRI of the injection site approximately 2 to 3 weeks after the diagnosis of meningitis. Early identification of new disease at the injection site may facilitate additional specific interventions such as drainage and provide information for measuring effectiveness of therapy thereafter. For patients who are demonstrated to have epidural abscess, phlegmon, discitis, or vertebral osteomyelitis, we think that early consultation with a neurosurgeon can be beneficial to discuss whether surgical management, including debridement, is warranted in addition to fungal antifungal therapy for these patients. As always, for information about antifungal treatment and management of these patients, please go to our website where we have treatment recommendations. We are always continuing to investigate this ongoing outbreak, gathering new data, and it's possible that as we get more information, these guidelines could change, so make sure to check those frequently. I will also say that CDC has set up a clinician consultation network, a network of ID physicians who have special expertise in treating fungal infections, who are being made available through the CDC to clinicians who are caring for patients involved in this outbreak. If you need additional assistance or additional information on individual patient management, In order to access this clinician consultation network, you can call CDC Info, which is 1-800-CDC-INFO, telling that you're a physician managing a patient that's involved in the fungal meningitis outbreak and that you'd like some expert clinical care, and they will connect you with the appropriate person. With that, I'll end my prepared comments, and we will open it up for questions. And we're delighted today to have joining us to participate in the question and answer phase, Dr. Anu Malani, who's already been introduced to you. Dr. Malani has been really the lead infectious disease clinician in caring for a large number of patients in Michigan. Around 140 patients have been treated at St. Joseph's Mercy Medical Center, and Dr. Malani has been overseeing treatment of those patients and has great frontline experience, and it's helpful to have him on the call today to help field some of the questions. I will emphasize that any comments that are made on this phone call today shouldn't be considered official consultation on any individual patient management. For that, you should consult local ID physicians or access this clinical consultation network. But we'll be trying to give general concepts and impressions based upon what we've seen here at CDC, and perhaps more importantly, what frontline ID clinicians who are accruing great experience with many of these patients are seeing on the front line through Dr. Malani. So with that, we'll end our formal comments and open it up for questions.
Thank you. At this time, we are ready to begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. You will be announced prior to asking your question. One moment, please. Our first question comes from Dr. Hatavi.
Yeah, I got a cool question. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
The question I have for you is, if patients are completely asymptomatic, when is it clear for us to possibly do injections on them again? I have quite a few patients who are not doing well with their pain ever since this occurred, so I'm just wondering, when is the time to clear these patients who are completely asymptomatic to proceed with injections for them?
You know, I wish we had a solid answer to that question, the answer is we simply don't know. There obviously is the theoretical risk that an exposed patient may have, active infection of their epidural space that may not be clinically manifest yet, and we simply don't know what the implications of injecting an anti-inflammatory medication into that potentially infected space could be. There is certainly the theoretical concern that that could make things worse, could alter the immune response such that an infection the immune system was starting to clear, you might tip that balance away and actually exacerbate things. But we don't know. That's a theoretical risk, and I wish I had a great answer for you on that. We simply don't know. I think that it's going to have to be an individual decision between the clinician and the patient, balancing theoretical risk that's there with the clinical implications of the pain syndrome that they have. And I think it's just going to have to be an individual decision in terms of giving a time course as to when it's safe to do. We don't know. We know from previous outbreaks of fungal meningitis associated with epidural steroid injections, the incubation period has been, at least in a few patients, quite long, many months, suggesting that there could be viable organisms present in the epidural space for some time. So, there should be some concern for several months. Beyond that, I can't give you a better answer than that. I'm sorry.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, Chris Henderson. Hendrickson.
Hi. I'm infection prevention at the University of Minnesota Medical Center on implants, and currently for infection preventionists looking out for potential new cases. We've been monitoring. We have 3 emergency rooms, we've been monitoring patients coming in there looking for, you know, headache or anything that sounds like it may be meningitis. And we're also tracking all the cerebral spinal fluids, those cultures, looking for anything unusual. And now when we get into the osteomyelitis or some of these other newer complications, for us to try and monitor all MRIs done across this campus would be probably impossible. But do you have any other ideas or discuss with any other IPs on in large multi-center facilities how they're doing this, or is there, are we kind of doing the best that we that you think we can right now with what we're doing?
Well, I'll make a comment, and Dr. Schaefer may want to comment as well. I think, in my opinion, the surveillance should focus on patients who have been exposed. That is, patients who have known injections with one of the three contaminated lots of methylprednisolone acetate formulated by the New England Compounding Center. And among those patients, you should be carefully monitoring for onset of symptoms, not only of meningitis with, you know, headache, fever, stiff neck, and all that stuff, but also new or worsening pain symptoms at the site of the injection, that might imply a localized infection associated with the actual injection. So I think that if I were you, I would try to focus my surveillance at this point on the cohort of patients who was actually exposed to one of the implicated lots. Dr. Schaefer, you have any additional comments on that?
No, I don't think I have anything to add. And you know, it sounds like you guys are you know, doing a very diligent effort here, and I'm sure that your clinicians and your frontline staff are very aware of the outbreak and the guidance that's being put out and what folks are seeing. And I think that's critical because they're the ones who are actually seeing the patients come in and taking the history and exam and can elicit, you know, that potential exposure from these folks. For those who haven't been on the prior COCA calls, you know, we've mentioned on the CDC website, we do list the 76 facilities that received these three lots of methylprednisolone acetate that have been associated with the outbreak, and that's another way to kind of figure out if they were potentially exposed to these medications.
Thank you. That was helpful.
Thank you. Next question comes from Dr. John Ballwinger.
Yes, thank you. I'm the chief medical officer at Union Hospital in Terre Haute, Indiana, and we've had about 100 exposures to the recall medication. The question I have now is how low should our threshold be for screening these patients with MRI looking for abscess formation?
I'll make a comment first, and then I'll let Dr. Milani relay some of his experience. I think that one of the purposes of putting out the HON last week was this, you know, this emergence of spinal and paraspinal infections as you know, the predominant cause of newly identified cases. You know, and it's pretty clear that this is emerging as a late manifestation of exposure. And I think part of the reason for the HON was to express that we think there should be a pretty low threshold. So if a patient's been exposed, has had a paraspinal injection or an epidural injection with one of the implicated lots, and they have anything in the way of new or worsening symptoms, I think there should be a very, very low threshold. I think they should get the MRI in that case. And again, if the patients are being treated with fungal meningitis, even a lower threshold later on in the illness, if they might consider getting an MRI. Anu, do you want to comment on that?
Sure. Yeah. So I would agree and echo what Dr. Juergen just said. I guess, you know, if there haven't been a lot of MRIs that have been done yet, I would probably prioritize. I think now, you know, you're at least last injections given September 26th, so you're probably seven weeks or maybe even longer out. I think probably the cases of fungal meningitis that we'll see, we're more than 7 weeks. We're actually a couple months out. So I think fungal meningitis by itself presenting now, I think that those cases, it's probably going to be a little unusual. I mean, you might see a couple cases here trickle here and there, but I think the predominant manifestations are going to be some sort of infection at the epidural site. I think in terms of priority, I would probably image the people that had fungal meningitis initially, and then I would probably, if I were going to have a tiered approach, and this is kind of an approach that we've undertaken, we would, you know, I would, the group two would be anyone that has increasing neck or back pain. I would image those folks as well. The third group would probably be those that are asymptomatic, I guess, quotation mark asymptomatic. And I think, as Dr. Jerrigan was saying, I think it's sometimes difficult to sort out in patients whether, you know, they're really truly asymptomatic or do they have a little bit of symptoms. I think, again, in this patient population, there's a reason why they got epidural steroid injections in the first place. They have some sort of chronic pain, and many of them kind of deal with chronic pain. And I think sometimes the pain is subtle, and it's not till they maybe undergo some sort of operative intervention do they realize that, you know, actually I feel much better. So I would I would have a very low threshold to MRI folks. And then the question is, and I don't think anyone knows the answer to this, is if you have a negative MRI now, does it mean you're out of the woods? And I'm not sure that we can say that. I think as far as we know right now, I think the longest duration of symptoms that I've at least heard about has been about 4 months from 4 months from injection to an epidural infection. And so I suspect that we're going to even see longer duration of symptoms as we continue to image folks. So hopefully that helps a little bit.
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and it's Dr. Jernigan again. Let me just emphasize that currently CDC actually does not recommend MRI for exposed patients who are completely asymptomatic. So that's not our current recommendation. I do think that what Dr. Milani points out is that that these are patients who, you know, the reason they got epidural steroid injections is because they have chronic pain syndromes at the site of injection, usually. And many times, as I said, this is chronic. And so sometimes it can be very difficult to sort out what's baseline chronic pain and what are new symptoms. And that can be a tricky business. But So I think that's where the physician needs to be very vigilant, have a low threshold if they think there's any hint that things are getting worse or not, you know, responding clinically the way they want. But currently, the CDC's recommendation is we do not recommend MRIs in exposed patients who are completely asymptomatic. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, LLC. Hello, Saint. Go ahead, please.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. This is my first call that I've joined about this, and somebody actually sort of answered my question. Well, asked the question that I was going to ask about patients coming in, and if they're, you know, chronic pain, and they've been getting a series of these steroid injections. Is there any adjunct test results that we would also order? To kind of, you know, decide whether to get the MRI. And then I work in a rural facility, so we would probably either have to have them admitted or probably transferred to a facility that would be able to provide the MRI with the contrast. So in that kind of case, it's like, which patients would I really be like, okay, I need to have them either admitted so they can get the MRI or transfer to a facility. Is there any subsequent labs or test results or tests that we would order to, or is it just more clinical?
I think that probably the best diagnostic test that we know of at the moment is an MRI with contrast if there's some concern that they may have an infection localizing to the site of the injection or nearby there.
Okay.
So I think that is the test. You know, the tricky part is whether you're, you know, when to get it exactly. And I guess if there's, you know, what we're saying is that for patients who are having pain, who've been exposed, the threshold should be pretty low to get that.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Marlise Charney.
Yes, hi. I was wondering if you could comment or update us on any issues with the cardioplegic solutions that were mentioned. I haven't really heard much.
Yeah, so this is Dr. Schaefer. I don't think we have any updates to provide at this time on the CDC and FDA website. You'll notice that we have been posting results as they've been available of testing of product from the New England Compounding Center. But as far as any additional cases that have been identified associated with cardioplegia, we're not aware of any confirmed cases that have confirmed infections that have been associated with use of that drug.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, Janelle Alicia.
Fine, thanks very much. I have a question about, I wonder what proportion of the new cases that are presenting are these ancillary infections such as the abscesses and arachnoiditis? Is it all of them? Is it, what proportion, if you could tell me?
I don't have the exact numbers right in front of me, but I will refer you to, you know, to our website, and you can actually look at that that health advisory notice, and there's a graph there that shows, and you'll see of the case, the last bar on this is looking at cases that were diagnosed between 11/11/11/17, and you can see that the vast majority of those were in fact either osteomyelitis or abscess. As of November 4th, now this is a little older data, but this is the last hard data I have. 67% of the cases had spinal or paraspinal epidural abscess or osteomyelitis. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah. So in the HON, you know, which as John mentioned was from last week, so the numbers are a little outdated, although not significantly outdated. We mentioned that the 91 cases that had come in since November 4th, at the time the HON was released. Of those 91, about two-thirds of them were patients who were presenting with spinal or paraspinal epidural abscess or osteo.
And those infections alone without fungal meningitis or both in conjunction and alone?
I believe those were alone.
Oh, okay. Huh. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. John Lang?
Yes, hi. Two questions. First, I mean, you mentioned doing these studies to look for local infections. Any evidence that shows that drainage helps? Again, this must be very complex being right near the spine if there can be spine surgeons to operate on these.
Yes, we do think that for patients who have epidural abscess, there is some suggestion that surgical debridement and drainage may be of benefit. And that's one of the reasons why we encourage folks to involve neurosurgeons early. I'll let Dr. Milani comment on his experience in Michigan.
I would concur with that. We've had many patients that have gone for operative intervention, probably well over 60, and a majority of these patients feel dramatically better after their surgery. I think there are a couple differences with this, I guess, second wave of infection as opposed to the fungal meningitis. And many of these patients seem to have fungus or organisms seen on their path. Many of them also have fungus that actually grows in their cultures, as opposed to the meningitis patients, where it was kind of few, only a few of them probably actually grew. But I would say, you know, majority of the patients that go for operative intervention, they feel much better. And in terms of just, again, talking about symptomatic, asymptomatic, not about screening, but sometimes these patients actually don't realize how symptomatic they were until they undergo operative intervention. And as far as, you know, we still don't know exactly how they're going to do because it hasn't been long enough. We're only about 8 or 9 weeks into the outbreak. But a lot of our patients that we've seen in the last few weeks, I mean, most of the cases that we've seen have really been epidural infections or some sort of process in the epidural space. And many of these patients have now gone home, and most of them are actually doing quite well.
The other one is a patient here that originally presented more of a meningitis, went on voriconazole, had improvement. However, they had new pain down their left leg, which they never had before. An MRI showed progression of arachnoiditis, nerve root involvement on the left. Then went on liposomal amphotericin, and even a further follow-up study while on amphotericin and the voriconazole shows progression of the arachnoiditis further up the cord area. Anyone seen this type of while on therapy?
So I guess I can comment a little bit on that. So we've seen several cases of arachnoiditis, and I think that's also one of the I don't know if we completely understand the pathogenesis of this infection, but clearly we've seen some patients that seem to have the infection starts off epidurally and seems to spread to the intradural area, and some have developed arachnoiditis. I think, you know, our experience here, and I think this is shared by there's been some other surgeons, neurosurgeons in the country that have seen this, that there are some patients that when they underwent biopsies of their intradural area, they actually had some fungus seen there. And once it involves the nerve roots or arachnoiditis, I think that's felt in terms of the neurosurgeons, is that that's probably an area that's not really amenable to surgical treatment. We have, you know, a lot of cases of arachnoiditis. I would say that most of them have improved on combination therapy. And in fact, we've had some people recently go home after prolonged stays of combination therapy. So I think that people can improve. And people seem to be improving on combination therapy. I think as far as the imaging that you're talking about, I think, you know, we've seen imaging kind of stay the same even, you know, 2 to 4 weeks out. I'm not sure what that really means. I suspect imaging lags behind. And maybe, you know, in this patient population, those that have arachnoiditis, really imaging at 4 weeks or longer, it may be more appropriate. But even despite their imaging staying stagnant or being about the same, clinically they're better. They're much better. So I guess I would say for that patient, the patient that's on combination therapy, I would ask you if they actually feel better. And as far as surgery, if there's not really an epidural component to their infection, I'm not sure that the arachnoiditis by itself, it's probably not amenable to surgical treatment.
I actually have a third question. Have they done any fungal testing on these Xero hilum, and what is the MIC they've been obtaining?
Yes, there have been a number of clinical isolates that have been and looked at, and in general, I don't have the figures right in front of me, but the MICs have been mainly in the 1 to 2 microgram per milliliter range.
For voriconazole?
Sorry?
For the voriconazole?
Conazole, yes, and much lower for amphotericin B.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, James Molnar.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I've got a couple of questions. Number one is I have a couple of patients with the arachnoiditis presentation, and the question often comes up is, on the imaging, is there any way to better discern intradural from extradural? Because we will debate around the films back and forth frequently. Is that extradural? Is that intradural? Has anybody found any particular points of view or items? Because some of these patients both the patients have continued to slowly deteriorate in kind of a stutter step way despite dual treatment. And was just wondering if anybody had feedback about that.
Anu, why don't you take that one?
I think that that's I think it's difficult. You know, we've had some multidisciplinary spine conferences where we've had our neurosurgeons, our radiologists, our anesthesiologists, infectious disease present, and clearly there's you know, it's not always clear, even when you have a neuroradiologist looking at the MRIs and a neurosurgeon, and sometimes they look at things differently in terms of imaging. I know our radiologists really like some of the T1 fat suppression images. I think that that's helped in delineating some of the processes a little bit better. But I think that that's I think the axial views also. But I don't really have much more to add about that. I think it's difficult, and I share your I share your concern and agony.
Yeah, that's a good word for it. Just two follow-up questions. In terms of people when they're not clinically improving, are there, in some of the patients we've been struggling to maintain their voriconazole levels above one, if not two, simply because there are obviously some rapid metabolizers. Has anybody gotten more aggressive in their dose titration?
It's funny, you know, because we have troughs all over the place. We have troughs less than one and up to 16. And clearly, you know, the toxicity of voriconazole is real. It's all over the place, from people hallucinating to photopsia to QT prolongation to people just kind of generally not feeling well to LFT or abnormalities. Just offhand, most people we start off at 6 mg per kg twice daily, and pending levels will back down a little bit, shooting for troughs probably, 3 to 5-ish. But there have been a couple hypermetabolizers, and I can tell you in one patient we actually tried using omeprazole, which is a CYP 219 inhibitor. We tried using omeprazole twice daily. Actually seemed to bump up her levels, and her, she's almost on 10 mg per kg twice daily.
Wow.
And we really had low levels, and we really needed to get it in her. She had arachnoiditis.
Right. And that's what I was trying to do, both my cases of arachnoiditis and wanting to make sure we keep as good of a level up.
Yeah, and I think it's the fine balance between toxicity and achieving a level that, seems to be okay for them, and making sure that they don't develop hepatotoxicity with the increased dosing.
Yeah.
I think that area becomes especially important as people, eventually leave the hospital and probably are not going to be on AmBisome treatment.
Mm-hmm. Well, my other question is about people that are falling on the cracks. I have a couple of patients who had exposure. MRIs have shown some minimal uptake on enhancement, like not in a particular area, but like the dural line. But those have been stable and unchanged now since their injection back in late September 14th on two separate MRIs separated by 3 or 4 weeks, and two LPs also negative for any pleocytosis, although they do have a slightly increased protein, normal at our institution being about 50, and they're about 75 or 80-ish, of which the majority of that is albumin when I had it broken down, reflecting serum uptake. And I didn't know if anybody else has had any reports of this, because I'm suspicious that they have something, but I'm not able to show that they have anything at all.
Are they symptomatic?
Only in terms of their usual symptoms. And, again, most of these people have fairly significant stenosis complaints, and they will have waxing and waning sort of complaints, although have a little numbness here when they sleep wrong. It's like, well, you've got bad stenosis at C5-6. But neurologically, they're unchanged. They have no headaches, no sign of a meningeal pattern. They've been this way since 9/14.
And your MRIs, are they a month apart, or how far
apart? About a month apart, 3 or 4 weeks apart, as are the LPs.
Yeah.
I've been basically seeing her every other week, and repeating the studies basically every other week after that. So
yeah.
We're at, 70-some days now?
Yeah, I suspect that what you're describing is an area that we're all facing right now, is these people with these subtle MRI changes. Are they real? Are they not real? What to do about them? And I don't know if it, at least from our experience thus far, I don't know if it's clear yet. I mean, we have patients like you're describing that we're following off of therapy, repeating MRIs.
Okay.
I can also tell you anecdotally that we've also had people, folks that have had very subtle changes and not even really clear why they got an MRI, but they got an MRI and they happened to get admitted and they happened to undergo surgery and then they've actually had infection present. I think it's an area it's not well defined. I think we'll probably learn more in the coming weeks as we continue to repeat MRIs and see if some people are progressing. But I think in that patient, if they seem to be doing well and you have stable MRIs, it seems reasonable to me that I would maybe watch them clinically and, again, have a low threshold for performing imaging. It's, you know, it seems at least in the ones that have developed infection, they often seem to progress a little bit. And if you have two stable MRIs that are a month apart and they're clinically doing okay, I think maybe you watch them and see. It sounds like, you know, you probably have to repeat an MRI at some point in time again.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difficult part because, you know, even if you MRI these folks right now is, you know, when can you say you're out of the woods? And I don't think we have those answers yet.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Dr. Kadobi.
I was just wondering if there's been any legal actions against physicians that you know of.
I can't comment on that. I'm not information that I'm privy to. So, sorry.
Thank you. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star one.
Operator, excuse me. How many do we have in the queue?
I just have one participant left in the queue.
Okay, we'll go ahead and take that one question.
All right. Thank you. Have not recorded your name. If you would like to ask a question, your line's open. Please go ahead. Pick up your handset or check your mute button. I'll clear their question out. Did you want to take any more questions at this time? I have three that just queued up.
Sure, that's okay. Go ahead.
Thank you. One moment, please. Robin, go ahead, please.
Thank you. Hello. Just want to clarify that all of the cases that are being reported up to this point are indeed those that have received one of the three lots of the methylprednisolone acetate, even the newer ones that are showing up with the osteomyelitis and the epidural abscesses?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. My second question follow-up is there any information available on the new reports from the betamethasone or the triamcinolone from that same company?
So as I mentioned, FDA posted on their website results of testing of that they performed in the FDA lab, and I think that's what you're getting at, and mentioning that there was fungal growth with identification pending in betamethasone and in triamcinolone, two different lots. CDC has received the isolates and is looking at those, and I don't have any more information right now, but as soon as we do, we'll get that out to all of you.
Okay, and just really quickly, the triamcinolone that's been listed on the FDA website, do you know if it's preservative-free or with preservative?
I only know what is posted on the website, and I don't know that it's indicated. Let me see here. I don't see that specifically in here, so I'm not certain about that.
Okay. All right. Thank you for your help.
Yep. Thank you. Next question, Camille Jones.
Hi. I was just wondering, is there any sort of financial assistance available for the cases from any of the manufacturers? Monitoring surveillance?
I am not aware of such. Anu, have you heard of anything like that?
Say that again, I'm sorry.
Financial assistance for patients with regard to treatment or monitoring, et cetera.
I know Pfizer, one of the manufacturers of voriconazole, they have I think it's called an RSVP program. So it's a compassionate use program. And I know that I believe we've had at least some patients get assistance with voriconazole through that mechanism. I don't know of anything else.
Okay.
Thank you. Sue Eastland?
Yes, hi, thank you. Earlier in the call, it sounded like the emphasis for the diagnostic treatment guidance was for those patients who were known to have received one of those three tainted lots of methylprednisolone acetate. But based on the conversation that we just had with Robin's question, should we follow that same guidance if we have a patient present that did receive a NEC product after 5/21?
Well, I would say that our guidance is focused right now exclusively on those that have received one of the three contaminated products. We know that we can't consider other products from NEC to be safe, and that physicians should always be vigilant that there might be, that their patient could have something going on. I will say that CDC has not confirmed, does not have laboratory confirmation of any fungal or other infection caused by other NEC products other than the three implicated lots. So our guidance is geared toward those who are exposed to one of those three lots. But, you know, there should be some level of vigilance, as always, in patients that there could be some complication for an injection. But I don't think the guidance would be exactly the same.
Well, if we were in a state and we had a patient who had an epidural abscess that was from and had received a related NEC product, not one of the three implicated lots, and we provided that information to the state, how would we know if that had been forwarded on to the CDC? Because this was early in the scheme of things before these other epidural abscess cases cropped up. It was just something that our physicians were in tune to and on top of and said, oh, by the way, we did have an epidural abscess patient. And that patient did receive NEC triamcinolone.
But so I think, like, you can follow up with the
early when all of this was going on. We did report it to our State Department of Public Health, and at that point then, they don't let us know whether they passed that on to the CDC or not.
You can follow up with them and find out if that was the case.
And then we'd also encourage you to report any potential adverse events that you think are linked to a product from NECC to FDA and MedWatch. They are also, you know, collecting this information, tracking it, looking for signals or, you know, associated with products from NECC. So it's also important that they're getting, you know, any information about these reports.
We did. We did report it to the FDA concurrently.
And what state are you from?
Alabama.
Alabama. Okay.
I think it's also important to keep in mind, and I'm not saying this is the case in your particular patient, but you know, there is a background rate of complications associated with epidural injections that extend beyond this particular outbreak. I mean,
right, and the gram-positive bacteria that grew with, I mean, we worked it up and submitted it because it fell into the reportable definitions, but we were not concerned about it being NEC-related. As this has gone on, however, you know, we certainly, I guess, at our facility have a heightened sensitivity to it. And that's why I was wondering if the guidance regarding the MRIs, et cetera, was expanded to those other NEC products. But I understand your point that currently it is not. That's not the focus.
Next question.
Thank you, Ms. Wagner.
Yes, we have a group of patients that were wondering about future procedures, elective surgeries, those type of things, for both the patients having received contaminated injections, and I'm speaking of elective surgeries outside of the spine area or other procedures, and then also the group of patients who've received other NECC meds. What are the thoughts about doing procedures, elective surgeries, or implants or other spine injections on those who received NECC meds which have not so far been linked to contamination or infection?
So as I mentioned before, we're not aware of any laboratory-confirmed infections caused by other NEC products. So we don't have any recommendation on that specifically. With regard to patients who were exposed, these are patients who are exposed but not known to have an infection?
Yes.
I don't think we have any formal recommendation on that, just in my own clinical opinion, if the patient's not manifesting any evidence of infection, and if, in fact, the procedure has nothing to do with that particular body site, I don't see any major contraindication to proceeding. I think, again, and at the end, it's going to be a decision between the clinician performing the procedure and the patient and discussing risk benefits. I think, again, this is pure supposition on my part, but in a patient who's been exposed but has not manifested any evidence of infection and who's not going to have any procedure having to do with the site of injection, the risk has got to be pretty low.
Thank you. Would you think there'd be increased risk with an implant surgery, like when they're placing any implants, like a knee replacement?
I have no way of quantifying that risk. If, you know, I think in an abundance of caution, if they could put it off for some period of time, that might not be a bad idea. I don't know. Anu, you have any thoughts on this issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think we as an institution really, again, I mean, for right or wrong, I point that out, we have tried to hold off on elective surgeries. Again, as we've kind of mentioned on this call, I don't know when you can effectively say folks that received ESI injections are out of the woods. And one thing to keep in mind is if they do develop an infection and say they undergo some sort of procedure or going to get a procedure, I mean, you know, there are risks of drug interactions and drug toxicity, and antifungals are not easy to take. So I would agree that the risk is probably low, but just to have a blanket policy, I mean, our policy is going to be let's hold off until we can really kind of, again, elective procedures, until we can effectively say that, you know, okay, we think people are probably not going to develop infection. The same thing, I think it was mentioned before, I think the first respondent had mentioned about repeat epidural steroid injections. I would kind of say the same thing about those, and almost the same class. Again, for right or wrong, is that, you know, we're trying to hold off on those types of procedures for this cohort of patients.
Thank you. Next question, Susan.
Yes, I was going to ask about the betamethasone that was reported on the FDA's webpage. You commented briefly that you were waiting for additional information. Do you have anything else that you could add, or if you could repeat what you mentioned earlier?
Yeah, I don't have any additional information at this point. On the FDA website, as I mentioned, they have a table listing, what products they've tested and found to be contaminated. And as I mentioned, you know, they've posted that for betamethasone and triamcinolone, two different lots, that they detected fungal growth and identification was pending. I don't have any additional information at this time, but certainly when we do, we'll make sure that you all have it as well.
So have there been any reports of illness associated?
As Dr. Jernigan mentioned, we don't have any laboratory-confirmed reports of infections associated, with these other products. We've been looking, and as I mentioned, FDA is certainly collecting, MedWatch reports, and again, encourage all of you, if you have any adverse events that you believe to be associated with any medication, but certainly any of these products from NECC, to be reporting that to FDA so that we're getting them in a systematic way and can look for any signals associated with a particular medication. Obviously, again, as Dr. Jernigan, reiterated earlier, the sterility of any of these products is not, we don't think that they're necessarily sterile, which is why they've been recalled and why, FDA made the recommendation that patients be notified, a certain subset of patients be notified. So, these findings are not necessarily surprising or unexpected as far as contamination in these products.
So should patients follow the same type of protocol then to proceed with caution in terms of elective procedures and surgeries?
So I think that was the question that was just asked, and I think...
I think the guidance we're talking about, the guidance on our web, pertains to patients who have been exposed to one of three contaminated lots of MPA associated with NEC. We don't know the risk associated with other products. As we've said, there's been no laboratory-confirmed evidence that these other products have caused infections. So this we have no recommendations on for those patients. Again, I think, you know, clinicians for any patient, even outside of this outbreak, you know, need to be vigilant for what's going on with their patients. And if there's something going on clinically that suggests that they might have an infection at a site where one of these products was used, they need to investigate it. And if there's something that suggests that there's an infection that was related to a contamination event, they should report it to the FDA. And if there's a pattern, you know, that emerges, certainly we'll be looking for those things. So.
Thank you.
Operator, we have time for one more question.
Thank you. Our last question comes from Christine Sajira.
Yes, hello. I'm one of the patient care supervisors or assistant managers of Southdale Emergency Room, and Edina, Minnesota has gotten at least 100 patients come in. My responsibility as part of the ED is to log and to report to our infection control and our infection department. And I have been getting recently some repeat patients coming in. Most of the time, you know, they tell us that they've been exposed. And the question I've been getting is, one patient I had last week actually had been tested at another facility in the Minneapolis area 2 weeks ago, had a negative TAP, but then she came back in with abdominal pain and other symptoms not related. I did put her on the board, and I did log that to have that reported just to send it in. But are we still tracking patients who did say they got the contaminated, even if they have symptoms that may not be related to this? Is this information you still want to receive?
I think that basically the follow-up of those patients who have been exposed but have shown no evidence of infection related to their injection, the follow-up is primarily between that patient and their clinician, and we think that the clinicians, their physicians, should follow them closely and, you know, be vigilant for signs or symptoms that could be related to an injection-related infection. Obviously, people are going to have other things that go wrong. In this case, you know, the abdominal pain, you know, sounds like it's probably unrelated, but that's a clinical judgment that the physician is going to have to make, whether they need to be evaluated for either meningitis or an infection at the localized site of the injection. So that, I think, just to summarize, for those patients, again, who've been exposed but have shown no evidence of infection to date, the follow-up should be primarily between the physician and the patient, and they should both be informed of what signs and symptoms of infection might be and to be vigilant for those, and should those particular symptoms develop, then they should be investigated accordingly.
So do you want us to still send in the information if they come in and it's a symptom that's not related to their previous injection?
So are you asking about reporting to your health department? Because CDC hasn't been getting reports of, you know, patients who don't meet the clinical case definition, per se. So I think your question is, I don't know if your hospital is keeping the is in close contact with the health department, and they're the ones who you're sharing this information with. If so, they'd be the one to direct that question to.
Gotcha. Yeah, they're the ones. We send it to the health department, and then they forward the information to you. But I have been, physicians have been asking me that question, is because they've been exposed in the past, if they have new symptoms, is this something we're still supposed to be tracking? And I wasn't sure on that answer, if it was not related to injection, but because there were possibly other medications involved, that's what the physicians are questioning.
So I think, you know, what CDC is collecting and reporting are those that meet the clinical case definition, come to us from the state health department. I think I'd follow up with your health department on how they want you to report or track these other potentially exposed patients who have not yet converted over to a case, to meet a case definition.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
On behalf of COCA, I would like to thank everyone for joining us today, with a special thank you to our presenters, Dr. Schaefer, Dr. Jernigan, and Dr. Milani. We invite you to communicate to our presenters after the webinar. If you have additional questions for today's presenters, please email us at coca@cdc.gov. Put November 27th COCA call in the subject line of your email, and we will ensure that your question is forwarded to the presenters for response. Again, that email address is coca@cdc.gov. The recording of this call and the transcript will be posted to the COCA website at emergency.cdc.gov/ COCA within the next few days. There are no continuing educations for this call. Meningitis resources for clinicians are available on their COCA page. Go to emergency.cdc.gov/COCA, click COCA calls, and follow the links for the meningitis call. To receive information on upcoming COCA calls, subscribe to COCA by sending an email to COCA@cdc.gov and write subscribe in the subject line. CDC launched a Facebook page for health partners. Like our page at facebook.com/CDC Health Partners Outreach to receive COCA updates. Thank you again for being part of today's COCA call. Have a great day.
This concludes today's conference call. Thank you for joining. All parties may disconnect at this time.